A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Would you believe cosmic dust reveals a hidden history of past sea ice? That it predicts a crash of Arctic Ocean life? That warming air, not warmer seas, drives sea ice loss? We explore stories of cosmic dust with lead author of a new paper, Dr. Frank Pavia from the University of Washington. Frank is an isotope geochemist with new tools to explore past and present climate. From Washington State, Frank Pavia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for the introduction.
Well, you and your colleagues just published Cosmic Dust Reveals Dynamic Shifts in Central Arctic Sea Ice Coverage Over the Past 30,000 Years. It's a big new view, so we need to start with a couple of basics. What is cosmic dust?
Yeah, so cosmic dust means something different to, say, an astrophysicist than it does to, a climate scientist or a geochemist. So cosmic dust, as, you know, we apply it here, we're talking about stuff that initially forms as debris from collisions between solar system bodies, things like comets and asteroids. And that generates much smaller, right, sizes of grains in the solar system. Now, finer grained materials in the solar system go into orbit around the sun, just like everything else. But there's drag on them, and that causes them to lose angular momentum and start spiraling in towards the sun. And as that happens, these cosmic dust grains get bombarded with the solar wind. And the solar wind, right, the sun is doing fusion, it's turning hydrogen into helium. The solar wind is extremely enriched relative to Earth materials in a rare isotope of helium, helium-3. And so that solar wind embeds this rare helium isotope signature into these cosmic dust grains as they spiral towards the sun. Now, on their transit, they can intersect Earth, right, and pass through Earth's atmosphere. As they pass through Earth's atmosphere, the biggest of these grains get heated more than the smallest of these grains. And the big grains will lose and degas their helium. And only the smallest of these cosmic dust grains, we're talking about things that are 10 to 20 microns in diameter or so, retain their rare helium signature. And then, as they've passed through the atmosphere and retained their chemical signature of this rare helium, they blanket Earth's surface, and they blanket Earth's surface at a constant rate in space and time. And so we're using this principle that there is this constant rain of cosmic dust to Earth's surface in space and time over the past few hundred thousand years as a tool that we can use to try and study the way that the Earth and its oceans change in the past.
So it's important to note here that the helium-3 variety or isotope that you're looking at is only extraterrestrial. It wouldn't be found on Earth. It has to come from space. And what is the second element featured in your study, thorium-230? Why choose that?
Yeah, great question. So this is near and dear to my heart. I've spent most of my young career so far measuring decay products of uranium in the natural environment. So thorium-230 is an isotope that we're using as a benchmark to tell us how much cosmic dust-derived helium-3 we expect in our sediments. And just like helium-3, we're taking advantage of this property of thorium-230 that it rains down to the seafloor at a constant rate in space and time. So helium-3 is coming in from outer space and passing through Earth's atmosphere. Thorium-230 has a cycle that is completely contained within the water itself. So ocean water has about 3 parts per billion or so of uranium in it, right? That's completely natural. Uranium is extremely soluble in seawater, and so it's more or less evenly distributed throughout the entire ocean at a constant concentration. Now, that uranium will undergo radioactive decay, and the isotope uranium-234 radioactive decays into thorium-230. So because uranium is at a constant concentration in the ocean, this production of thorium-230 is happening at roughly the same rate everywhere in seawater. Now, unlike uranium, thorium is extremely insoluble in seawater. And so when you produce thorium-230 by radioactive decay, it sticks to particles in the ocean, which carry it downward towards the seafloor. And it's so sticky to these particles, it's so insoluble, that it's really hard to redistribute thorium across, you know, different spatial scales. And so the result is that all of the thorium produced by uranium decay in one place gets buried locally at the same place. And since we know how much uranium is in the seawater, and we know the depth of the ocean at a given location where we're measuring sediments, we know, right, how much thorium-230 is getting buried at the seafloor at that location. And, right, the key here is that because we know how much thorium-230 is getting buried at the seafloor at a given location, and we know what the input rate to Earth's surface of extraterrestrial helium-3 is in space and time, we can use thorium-230 to give us a prediction of how much helium-3 is supposed to be there. And then if we measure helium-3 and we see a deficit or enrichment in helium-3 relative to how much is supposed to be there, we can interpret that in terms of changing helium supply mediated by ice coverage at the sea surface.
Right. The helium can't get to the bottom because it's interrupted by the sea ice. So where did your seabed samples come from and how are they analyzed?
Yeah, so the seabed samples come from 3 sites in the Arctic Ocean, primarily in the central Arctic and then bleeding over towards the Pacific side in the western Arctic. Right, these sediments were collected in an expedition in 1994, so long before I was a practicing scientist or even in elementary school for that matter. And they were collected on an expedition that was actually the first major U.S. research expedition to reach the North Pole. And these sediments were collected and then stored for, you know, over 30 years by the U.S. Geological Survey. And they've turned out to be a treasure trove of really interesting information about Earth's climate over these past 30,000 years or so. And, right, there's been 3 or 4 new papers that have come out using these sediments as new analytical techniques have emerged over the past 5 to 6 years, right? That now we can go back to this sort of gold mine of sediments that were collected over 30 years ago and apply these new techniques to. So, right, I think the second question here was, what did we do to analyze our samples for thorium-230 and helium-3? So these cores had been subsampled already at about 1 centimeter increments. And so we got a whole series of 1 centimeter increment sediment samples to measure for both thorium-230 and helium-3. To measure thorium-230, we completely dissolved the sediments in a series of strong acids. And we take that dissolved sediment and pass it through a series of anion exchange chromatography columns And the goal of this is to isolate just the thorium and uranium from everything else that's present in the sample, all the different elements. And once we've isolated that uranium and thorium, we measure it using plasma mass spectrometer that we can use to separate different isotopes by their mass to charge ratio and detect how much is present in a sample. To measure helium-3, we take a separate small amount of that same piece of sediment. We leach it in dilute acetic acid, right, the same stuff as vinegar, essentially, to get rid of any calcium carbonate that might be in the sample. And then we dry it and we pack it into little foil balls. And once we've got those little foil balls with, you know, 50 to 75 milligrams or so of sediment in them, we drop them into a furnace that's held under vacuum. And once this is in the furnace, we heat the furnace up to something like 1300 degrees C. And all of the gas that's present in that sample then degasses right as you melt the sample. We take that gas through a vacuum line where we react out reactive gases like CO2, like nitrogen, and with the goal of leaving ourselves with just noble gases. And once we've got just these noble unreactive gases left, we freeze them down onto a cold trap held at something like 8 Kelvin with liquid helium, and that freezes all the noble gases down onto it, and then slowly raise the temperature. And as we raise the temperature of this cold trap to something like 20 Kelvin, we release helium off of the trap but keep all the other noble gases on. And once we've got that helium back in the gas phase, we then ionize it and bend it around a magnet to detect the helium ions by mass spectrometry as well.
My God, you're making me laugh. You know, once you get through these steps, it's not something we're going to do in our kitchen. And it's amazing anybody could put together those chain of events to get the results that you did. Now, I presume the Central Arctic was completely frozen over during the last big glacial age at the maximum time. And I looked it up, and it said there was about 29 meters of ice in the Central Arctic, maybe 85 feet. And the theory was, starting about 1970, that sea ice kind of spread out from the central hub of thick ice. But your paper suggests maybe not.
Yeah, so this is interesting. There's been a little bit of debate, both like recently and during the 1970s, about the sort of flavor of ice that covers the Arctic Ocean during glacial periods. And the essential question at hand is this ice covering the Arctic sea ice? That is, does it form on top of the ocean and then get transported around on top of the ocean? Or does it represent flowing ice from land that's grounded underwater that forms something like floating ice shelves or floating ice caps? I think that you're referring to this paper by Mercer in 1970 that argued potentially for these ice shelves. And then there is a follow-up paper that was published in 1975 by Wally Broker that argued for the presence of floating ice caps as well. And right, the reason why paleoclimate folks got sort of interested in this question is they were trying to figure out sea level rise, or sea level fall rather, during glacial periods, and to try and reconcile how the oxygen isotope ratio that they measured in both marine sediments and in ice cores could balance, right, via changes in both ocean temperature and continental ice. And the goal of this Broker paper in 1975 was to try and reconcile all of these with the presence of an ice cap in the Arctic that didn't really contribute anything to sea level change, but could change the oxygen isotope ratio balance of seawater and polar ice. I think more recently, right, that 29-meter number that you mentioned came from a climate modeling study that was attempting to model sea ice in the Arctic during glacial times. And, right, I think the evidence now points more closely to, at least during the last ice age, there being something more like sea ice than, you know, grounded terrestrial ice or floating ice shelves. Though there was a paper in 2021 by Walter Geibert that argued that during a previous glacial period, there was a thick ice shelf that covered the entirety of the Arctic, and that that ice shelf was accompanied by a freshening of almost the entire Arctic, which was a really fascinating and somewhat controversial paper that put out a lot of hypotheses to be tested by future work.
So according to the records indicated by the presence or absence of cosmic dust, when did sea ice start to retreat in the Arctic after the last glacial maximum?
Yeah, so the sea ice retreat really sort of commenced something about 15,000 years ago. And this gets into some issues with absolute dating versus relative dating in past climate studies. So developing chronologies of marine sediment records in the Arctic is pretty tricky, in part because sedimentation histories are complex, and in part because radiocarbon, the sort of classic tool that you use to generate age versus depth relationships in marine sediments, is somewhat more complicated in the Arctic. And so we have generated radiocarbon records that we use to develop these age depth models in our cores, but there's some uncertainty in the absolute ages of these cores, such that, right, delineating between something like 15,000 years ago and something like 13,000 years ago is a little bit trickier than if you were working with a sediment core, say, in the equatorial Pacific. But we can assess relative timing, that is, the timing of patterns that are discovered from analyses made in these same sediment cores that we analyze, a little bit more closely. And in particular, this is important for timing as we consider the changes in sea ice relative to large-scale changes in water inputs to the Arctic, mediated by the opening of the Bering Land Bridge, right, which was present as sea level was much lower during a glacial period in the Arctic roughly 11,000 years ago or so. And what we saw was that the decline that we saw during the deglaciation in sea ice coverage preceded the opening of the Bering Land Bridge and the opening of the Bering Strait for Pacific waters to get into the Arctic. And we were able to use that, right, because my colleague and the second author of this paper, Jesse Farmer, assessed the timing of the Bering Land Bridge opening and closing using nitrogen isotope measurements from these very same sediment samples where we made our sea ice reconstruction. And so even if we have some uncertainty on our absolute timing of our sediment records, our sediment depth in any given core, right, preserves relative time going from older to younger, going from the bottom to the top of the core. Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm still left with the question, how does that tell us a warmer atmosphere, not warmer seas, drove seasonal change to the sea ice in polar waters?
Yeah, great question. So, right, this allows us to eliminate one possible source of warmer waters to the Arctic in order to melt back glacial-style sea ice, right? And that's warm waters from the Pacific. So we got to have something else bringing heat in. And so our options remaining are the atmosphere and Atlantic waters, right, exchanging with the Arctic. And we don't actually conclusively rule out the Atlantic waters as a possible heat delivery mechanism, but we make some qualitative assessments based on the timing, right, of when these things change. But also, right, the relationship between the timing of reduced sea ice conditions with rising summer insolation, right, deduced from changes in Earth's orbit, warmer temperatures in Greenland ice cores during a similar time frame, and a limited set of records. There's really sort of one or two records out there that have tried to assess exchange of water between the Atlantic and the Arctic back through the same time interval. And there's really one paper that's sort of standing out in my mind about this, and that paper essentially found that there was minimal changes in Atlantic-Arctic exchange of water across the last 30,000 years, right? And so if that's the case, that sort of leads us back towards, well, then atmospheric heat delivery is a more likely candidate for, right, the melting back of sea ice. And in the modern ocean, right, sea ice forms at the base and it melts at the surface, right? But I would be hesitant to say that the that book is closed. And I think that, right, starting, you know, now that we have this record of how sea ice has changed over the last 30,000 years, it gives us an opportunity to really dig in and hash out what the mechanisms of these changes were in more detail.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Alex is talking with Dr. Frank Pavia about cosmic dust, sea ice, and life in a future Arctic Ocean.
Several papers suggest continued warming will lead to a boom of plankton and then nutrient starvation in the Arctic Ocean. Your paper adds some confirmation to that. Tell us about the process here.
Yeah, so there's sort of two ways that sea ice change can affect phytoplankton at the surface of the Arctic Ocean. And they both involve an increase in the fractional consumption of available nutrients at the sea surface. And this is a little bit of a tricky concept, right? Because if you've got a fractional change in nutrient utilization, you can either change the numerator or the denominator, which is to say that to more completely consume nutrients, you can either have phytoplankton grow more to consume more nutrients, or, right, you can change the denominator, and for a given amount of phytoplankton growth, you can decrease the inventory of available nutrients to phytoplankton. Okay, so sea ice decline gives two sorts of ways to modulate this. One is that sea ice inhibits light from getting to the surface of the ocean. And in this, and right, phytoplankton need light to be able to photosynthesize and grow and use nutrients. So as you melt back sea ice, you allow light in, and you can stimulate phytoplankton growth, productivity, and increase the utilization of nutrients at the sea surface. But there's also a physical effect on water stability that comes from melting sea ice. So the ocean is stratified by its density, and fresh waters are less dense than salty waters. And as you melt back sea ice, you put in fresh water to the surface of the ocean, and that stratifies the water, and it limits the depth over which the phytoplankton might be able to grow. And so this is the mechanism by which you decrease the inventory of available nutrients, and you can increase your fractional nutrient utilization by phytoplankton without changing the total amount of productivity, or by even shrinking the total amount of phytoplankton productivity. And so, right, what we found in our study was that there's really tight coupling of Arctic sea ice coverage with the fractional degree of nutrient utilization at the sea surface. But, right, we aren't able to decipher whether or not that's modulated by the physical mechanism or the biological mechanism. And so this is another example of a place where, now that we've seen this fundamental relationship, it's time to go in and start developing an understanding of what the mechanisms are behind it that we'll be able to use to sort of project our results to understand future change more directly.
Frank Pavia, previously you co-authored several papers on the dust of micronutrients that feed plankton. Geoengineering people want to use iron supplements to stimulate plankton blooms as a carbon reduction method. They want to know all about this. But how does dust move across the vast reaches of the Pacific Ocean?
Oh, yeah, great question. So, like, in a similar manner to cosmic dust being very fine-grained as it passes through Earth's atmosphere, by the time you get dust out to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, all that's left is the most fine grains, the smallest dust grains that are around. But it's the atmospheric circulation. It's the patterns of wind at Earth's surface that carry entrained dust from the continents all the way out to the center of the Pacific. So as far away as you can get from land, you have the atmosphere with its winds carrying dust that was entrained from land. And you have to have some small amount of dust that doesn't get deposited during earlier rainout events over the history of that air parcel that then gets rained out as that air parcel continues out over the Pacific. Now, the places where I was working on this kind of stuff in the middle of the South Pacific Gyre, essentially as far away from land as you can get anywhere on Earth, right, have the lowest amount of dust that reaches the ocean anywhere in the world's oceans, right? So these are end members in terms of how little dust they get, which is a really interesting place to then go study, because you want to know how ecosystems are primed to, right, having very minimal micronutrient inputs from dust.
Can we say with your recent new work that you found a new kind of clock showing the life of sea ice going back 30,000 years? And is there a limit? Could this method go back much further in time?
Yeah, so we have a little bit of a clock here. We're not able yet to say something directly about, say, sea ice formation rates or sea ice melting rates. And I think that that would be really powerful if we were able to do that as we continue our work. There is a limit in terms of time of how far back we can push this specific method. It's based on two things. But the major one is that thorium-230, the sort of index tool that we use to tell us how much extraterrestrial dust or helium-3 is supposed to be in our samples, thorium-230 is radioactive, and it has a half-life of about 75,000 years. So when we measure sedimentary records of thorium-230, we use the age of the sediments to correct thorium-230 for post-depositional decay to get back to what was the original concentration of it at the time of deposition. But as more and more thorium-230 half-lives elapse, our ability to do that goes away or gets really hard. And so you're sort of limited in your thorium-230 clock to something like 300,000 to 500,000 years. The second potential issue is that the constancy of the input of extraterrestrial helium-3 or cosmic dust has only really been conclusively established over the last 500,000 years or so. So you'd have to be making an assumption, or people would have to find clever ways to investigate the constancy of the cosmic dust flux further back in time before, right, you would start worrying about attributing possibly changes in helium-3 deposition to changes in helium-3 input from space or other processes rather than uniquely to sea ice coverage changes.
It's amazing. We picture Earth floating along through black, empty space, the void, but in fact space is dirty. Tons of stardust, if you will, lands here every day. We never see it. Frank, how did you end up chasing dust?
Oh, yeah, cosmic dust. So I ended up starting working on cosmic dust when I was a PhD student at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, which is part of Columbia University. And most of my work at the time was focused on the thorium-230 tool. And we were really interested in prodding a little bit how thorium-230 worked as a sedimentation tracer, both in seawater, in terms of its seawater chemistry, and in surface sediments. And we started using the combination of cosmic dust, helium-3, and thorium-230 in these South Pacific sediments to test the assumptions of how these two proxies for sediment accumulation worked. And so I had some history of working with the combination of helium-3 and thorium-230, but the history was for completely different applications, right? That was more the study of how does sedimentation work in these environments in the South Pacific where sedimentation rates are really, really, really low. And sea ice study was initiated during my postdoc, which I was doing at Caltech. And it was sort of early 2021, and it was not long after, you know, COVID shut down and we were back into our labs for the first time in a while. And I was sort of a hungry postdoc looking for cool scientific projects to work on. And I saw this paper had come out. I mentioned this paper earlier. It was the one that argued for the presence of a floating ice shelf in the Arctic during a previous glaciation. And this paper came out in 2021, and it used thorium-230 as a piece of evidence. And so I was already sort of like onto this paper as something that I was interested in. And I had worked on helium-3 and thorium-230 in concert before. And I started wondering whether or not helium-3 might be a way that you could tell if there was complete ice coverage at a given site in time because its input would be restricted by the coverage of that ice. Right, so it was knowing something about how cosmic dust and helium-3 worked and seeing a piece of scientific literature that seemingly asked for the application of helium-3 that then sort of set me off to the races. And I got in touch with Jesse Farmer, who's the second author of the paper that we just published. And Jesse and I had done our PhDs together at Lamont Doherty, and Jesse had worked extensively.